Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, broadcasting from Families USA Health Action Forum 2014 from Capitol Hill. And joining me now is Sister Simone Campbell, the Executive Director of Network. She's also a lawyer, an advocate, and a poet.
Yes.
Welcome to Background Briefing, Sister Simone Campbell.
Great to be with you.
And it's great to see you in person.
I know. What a treat.
We've spoken a lot on the phone, and I've enjoyed our conversations. In terms of getting the Affordable Care Act up and running, of course, you had a, were very instrumental in getting it passed through the Congress. You saw that
initially,
whole
yes.
unpleasant sausage making there, and it came down to the wire. It was your letter that got it passed.
Well, our letter certainly helped. It was signed by 59 Catholic sisters, heads of their religious communities, who said the Affordable Care Act was a good way forward. And the real controversy was that some staff in the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops was saying that there was federal funding of abortion in the bill. There's not. And two federal courts have now found, as a matter of law, our analysis was correct. And so I feel vindicated both by the courts and by the fact that now this good step forward is being implemented. It's a huge honor to have done that work.
And Bart Stupak was very key, was he not?
It was absolutely key.
And it was his religious beliefs that you...
Well, it was interesting. It was his faithfulness that was a part of it, but it was also the faith of many other members of Congress. A lot of people don't realize that over 25% of Congress are Roman Catholic. And mm-hmm. so what... Their faith matters to them, and so I've heard from many members of Congress that they were so grateful for the letter because it gave a different perspective, and that they had worried that voting against the bishop's position would be a problem. They thought the bill was okay, but having us come out say, yes, we've read the bill, it's fine. There is no federal funding of abortion, gave them a clarity of conscience that allowed them to. Congressman Stupak was one. He was a key leader of trying to make it happen, but there were many more that were affected.
But you led the nuns on the bus and went to Paul Ryan's district, and of course he ran for vice president on the Republican ticket. Have you been able to persuade him? He's coming up with apparently a Republican version of the Affordable Care Act, which seems a little bit late in the day, frankly.
It does seem a bit late, but the Republicans seem a little slow on this whole process of health care reform, but better late than never, maybe. But actually, his approach is so individualistic and so focused not on community, but on private gain, that he really misses the whole idea of the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act is about us being in this mm-hmm. together. We share responsibility for each other. And he doesn't seem to have that in his
mind. So in other words, not enough Jesus and too much Ayn Rand? Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, I believe. I wouldn't say it that way, but I think I agree with your analysis, yes.
But let's turn to John Kasich, because he's an example of somebody whose faith did the right thing, right?
Absolutely.
As opposed to the governor of Texas and the governor of Wisconsin, which I find, I cannot for the life of me understand how these governors could deny basic health care for millions of their citizens based on their own personal ideology. And I think even more and more unacceptable is that apparently it's their private political ambitions that are at stake. They think that if they're going to run for president, they've got to show that they're tough on the poor, you know?
Well, and this is the whole thing that's corrupting our society, our democracy, I believe, at this point, Ian, is that it is this fear of the far right, this fear that someone will sabotage my personal ambition, and that that fear is stronger than a concern for all our people. The fact that people within 133% of poverty cannot get health care in our country, I mean, this is wrong in the richest nation on earth. In my Bible, I carry this picture of Margaret, who died in 2012. Because she lost her job in the recession. When she lost her job, she lost her health care. She had a propensity for colon cancer, and by the time she finally went to an emergency hospital, she was terminally ill. And she died unnecessarily because she didn't have health care. If the Affordable Care Act was fully implemented with Medicaid expansion, Margaret could have gotten treatment and would be alive today and a contributing member to our society. To me, that is not only my pro-life stance that no more Margaret should die, but it's also about we're a nation that's better than that. We need our people to be able to contribute. And focusing just on political gain to the detriment of your citizens, of your state, That's wrong. That is just flat out wrong.
Well, Sister Simone Campbell, we've seen this sort of jihad against the Affordable Care Act, the relentless opposition, 42 times in the House they tried to vote
it
down.
Isn't that absurd?
I mean, it certainly entered the realms of the absurd, but that's not to say that in this political year it will not continue to be a political football. What's your sense, though? And I suspect that in many ways the opposition to it is based upon the fear that it just might work.
It's going to work. Absolutely. Right. I was just at a university giving a talk in their winter commencement, and an adjunct faculty came up to me and gave me a card and asked her business card and asked me to carry to my Bible for her sake of her husband and her two young kids, because she's an adjunct faculty. She'd never had been able to have health insurance. He was self-employed, and they got health insurance through the exchange. They got through the exchange and were finally able to afford health insurance. Christmas, before the health insurance kicks in, he got taken to the emergency in an ambulance. He ends up being diagnosed with cancer. But now, finally, because there's no exclusion for a pre-existing condition, and they finally can afford coverage, he's going to get treatment and still be there to care for his kids in the future. I mean, that's the right thing to do. So I think it's working. And the reason why we're hearing all this bad news is because that's the only thing the Republicans hope to scuttle it politically, but it's not good for our people. So.
Well, but let's face it, the three pillars of the foundation in our Constitution, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, arguably, and, you know, if health, I would say, is intimately connected to life.
Absolutely.
And intimately connected to happiness. And maybe it's being the liberty part's being misinterpreted by the libertarians, but, you know.
Well, I think the liberty part gets misinterpreted because they think of it as just individual, me and mine. And that the idea that we live in a society, a complex society like ours, and I can just take care of myself. Excuse me, we're sitting in a building that other people built. It's all about community. That's where we've gone wrong. And so that liberty is about how we can live in community confident that we'll care for each other. I am my sister's keeper. I am my brother's keeper. And so are you. So we need to do this together. That's where we run amok.
Well, in terms of individualism versus community, is that in any way an explanation for the growing disparity in wealth? I must say I find it extraordinary that we've reached the point in this country where just one family, the Walton family, the heirs to the Walmart family, own wealth that's the equivalent to 40% of all of the American households at the lower 40%. Now we also find out that just 85 individuals have the combined wealth equal to that of half of the world's population. That's 3.5 billion people. Just 85 people. This, to me, should be the issue of our day.
Well, absolutely. And it's the issue we think is the coming issue that we've got to address. Because, and it's wonderful because Pope Francis, who spoke on this, has said that it is this income and wealth disparity that is the source of violence in our society. It's the erosion of our sense of collaboration with each other. And it's causing us to decimate the earth because we think we have a right to suck everything out of the earth and no thought for the generation that come after us. So for us at Network, it is the key to moving forward. We've had this program that we call Mind the Gap. We've been doing it since 2011. And in 2011, we submitted a petition to the White House saying, hold a summit on income disparity in our nation. And it's taken a little longer than I thought to get the attention of the president, but he's talking about it. So I think we're making progress, but it is shocking. It's eroding our relationship with each other. And we've got to change it. It's wrong. It need not happen. It need not happen.
But given that there's only 85 people involved, it would seem to be attainable. If you could meet with 85
exactly.
people on this planet.
I want to make a house call. Don't you?
Go ahead.
Let's go.
We'll draw up a list.
Exactly. A pastoral visit. See,
right.
Because this is it. The thing that I know because of faith, okay, I do this politics part because of the Constitution, but because of faith, what I know from the gospel is the example of Jesus is all about touching the pain of the world and let your heart be broken. Let your heart be broken open But too often, very wealthy people get insulated from the pain of the world, so they never have a chance to have their heart broken open. So they're not aware of their relationship with others. They get too, I think those 85 probably don't know the joy of Southwest Airlines or Greyhound Bus. So I really think getting greater connection with real people could aid them in their own development.
But isn't human connection at the heart of so much of how our society has changed, in the sense that we are drifting apart and becoming atomized? I mean, how many times have you seen at a restaurant three or four people sitting down at a table all on their cell phones?
I know, doesn't that?
How many times?
Do you think they're texting each other? I don't know.
Well, that's what's so extraordinary. And I think that with children obsessed with video games, with children being babysat by television, do you think that in many ways we're losing our humanity because of that, where our society is evolving around atomization and isolation as opposed to community?
Well, I think it's a pendulum swing. And I think it sort of started with, in our nation, with Ronald Reagan and that whole idea of the Wild West was only built by an individual. And now I think the pendulum's coming back. I goof around and say, you know, the Bay of Fundy, where the tide goes so far out that it you know, all the boats get marooned on the mud flats. Well, even in the Bay of Fundy, the tide does change. So I think we're beginning to see the turning of the tide, and that we can make a difference. We have enough time to make a difference.
But in terms of technology, I mean, are we becoming slaves to it, and is it having a detrimental effect? I mean, if we are indeed, one of the things that I understand from my adventures into trying to understand economics and macroeconomics and what's happening, and we've talked about the biggest issue of all, the increasing gap between the rich and the poor. It does seem that jobs are becoming obsolete. And one of the reasons why our middle class is so distressed and working Americans are finding it so hard to have a living wage, that what we do effectively is we export jobs and, in effect, import cheap labor. And one of the arguments I've heard is that, well, jobs are becoming obsolete, you know, that when we export our jobs abroad, we replace them with robots. So it would seem to me that if this is inexorable and it's going to be difficult for all, we have so many challenges, is there a way to rethink work, that maybe work could involve more of what you do, in other words? You know, in other words, we don't all have to punch the time clock at a factory or go into a big insurance building or something. Maybe there's other things that we can do.
There's work to be done if we would only value it. I think one of the mistakes we've made is by valuing shifting, we shift the money to the top in a shareholder-driven perspective of short-term profit. There's plenty of work to be done. Look at our schools. We need more people in the schools working with kids and helping them learn to read and to think. People are just not thinking. I was just at a university yesterday, and one of the things, the written goal was for me to give a talk about politics and help the students think about diversity of perspective, because it didn't usually happen. And then I realized, well, I listen to the news that I like best, PBS, NPR, but other people listen to Fox or MSNBC. We don't cross-pollinate. We need a lot of work to be done to cross-pollinate so we learn to think and how do we talk to each other. There's tons of work to be done, but we don't value it enough to pay for it. And therein lies the trouble. Instead of shifting money to the shareholders or the CEOs, we need to use our money to improve we the people. That's where it's at.
Well, in fact, there's a term for what you're talking about. It's called reality shopping.
Ah.
That liberals get their information from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox, and so on and so forth, and that there is no consensus on what's true anymore. There's no town square.
That's right. We don't have to engage with each other.
Right.
So I've started advocating this thing that I call grocery store missionary work. When we're standing in line in the grocery store, don't talk about sports or the coming Super Bowl or any of that. Instead, say something important to the person behind you or in front of you. Say, have you thought about immigration reform? Or do you worry about these 85 people that have as much wealth as the half the world? Talk about something real. It's a great opportunity. The line never lasts too long, so if it's a bad conversation, you can get out of it soon enough. But what I've discovered is everybody has a thought about it. I've never had somebody say, no, I hadn't thought about it. Everybody's got a thought, but we just don't ask each other.
Well, one of the odd paradoxes of America is that some of the people who are most addressing the subjects that we've been talking about, income disparity, curiously enough, have been among the wealthiest Americans, like Warren Buffett, mm-hmm. who has warned that we are becoming a plantation economy. And if indeed it seems to be the case, we're heading into a kind of new feudalism. What I notice that's concurrent with the new economic feudalism is a social form of celebrity worship, which reminds me of what you're talking about being lining up at the supermarket. Because do you look at? People magazine.
Right.
You know, Obama's having an affair. I mean, and Michelle's angry. I mean, all this insane stuff that they make up, you know. But celebrity worship is so much a part of our culture. Do you think that is becoming a kind of palliative?
Well, that's an interesting issue. I haven't really thought about it. I must say that I've got some notoriety. It's always a shock to me that people say, oh, you're such like a rock star, all this stuff. It's like nuts. I'm still me. I'm the same person. And I'm imperfect. We have problems, but we don't like to see that people are human. But the glory of humanity is that we're all flawed. So I need you. You need me. We're in this together. And the beauty is that we complement each other. But if we've just got celebrities, they're like so rarefied, so out of there, we don't know how we're connected. It's a worry. It's a worry. But it's a substitute for real friends.
Well, that's what I noticed when out in Los Angeles, this young actor who's famous for these race car films, Fast and Furious series, he was killed in a horrible car accident.
I remember that.
But what happened was, for days and days and weeks afterwards, hundreds of people would go and stand around the spot where he died, and they interviewed all these people on television, and they were talking about as though this person who died was their friend, and they had no connection to them. But my sense was, my God, you know, you've got substitute friends instead of real friends.
Real friends. I do think that's a worry. I mean, people follow me on Facebook, and it worries me that I've got, I don't know, 6,000 friends and 8,000 Twitter followers. Twitter's okay by me because it's all about policy, but the friending part, it's a question.
Right.
It's a question.
Well, so just in closing then, let's try and sort of wrap up all of our challenges here, now that we've had this conversation, now that I'm feeling kind of weary.
Oh, no, don't feel weary. We're really making progress because the tide is turning. The fact that we're talking about poverty, we're talking about income and disparity, we're talking about all of the amazing things that the Affordable Care Act is accomplishing with its warts and all. We're also talking about the fact that we know in a globalized economy, we the people need to promote a sense of peace and collaboration. The fact that we're making progress with peace with Iran after all these years, that's huge progress. A lot of good stuff's happening. Yeah, we still got work to do. People are afraid of each other. We do it on electronically. Well, let's use the electronic media, and my idea is to infiltrate the ranks. Kind of seduce them into meeting real people. So I often tweet out, or sometimes tweet out, well, come meet my people. Come on. Come meet them. And that way we create the relationship. So we're doing the best we can. But I think we have to be careful to not get into old people syndrome. Oh, hell in a handbasket. Think we're going to hell in a handbasket. The fact is, there's a lot of youth. There's a lot of enthusiasm. There's a lot of opportunity. We can do all right. We'll do all right.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sister Simone Campbell.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Sister Simone Campbell, who is the Executive Director of Network, a lawyer, advocate, and poet. And by the way, in your new book, are we going to see some of your poetry?
Yes, 14 of my children, my poems will be in it. Yes.
Oh, excellent. I look forward to it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Sister Simone Campbell, who is the head of Network, a Catholic social justice organization. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer David Rosschert. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.